All right, so one of the mitzvahs that comes up in this coming week's parsha and parsha's Behar is the prohibition to engage in an interest-bearing loan. The pasuk says, "Al tikach me'itoy neshach v'sarbis v'reis melakecha v'cheachicha imach." And this is both to lend money with the intention of collecting ribbis, or to engage in to accept money with the intention of paying ribbis. Both parties are included, subsumed within this prohibition of engaging in a interest-bearing loan, either side of the transaction. However, throughout the generations, there was a device developed that evolved over time, known as the heteriska, which converts what would otherwise be an interest-bearing loan into an investment, and thereby transforms the interest into profits or dividends, which can then be given back to the principal or the investor, as opposed to giving it back to a lender. But in order for the heteriska to operate, it's imperative that the parties engaging this heteriska understand and appreciate the terms and the provisions that the heteriska provides for, and they have to enter into this arrangement wholeheartedly, understanding what it is that they are undertaking. And since it's so common, I thought it's kedai to review or to explain what exactly it is that the heteriska does, what it's predicated upon, and therefore if people engage in these things to understand what it is exactly that they're doing. But in order to appreciate this, to understand it, to explain it, let's put it or frame it in the context which the Torah does, which is in the context of issuing loans in the first place. The pasuk says in Parshas Mishpatim, "Im kesef talves ami," that if, or here it really should be translated, when you will lend money to your friend, because Rashi here writes that three times in Chumash that the word im doesn't mean if, but when. The expectation is that you will lend money to your friend without charging interest. The pasuk concludes, "Im kesef talves ami," said, when you lend money to your friend, don't burden him or place upon him the responsibility to pay interest on the loan. It's a mitzvah to grant non-interest-bearing loans. In fact, there are communities that have this as a gemach. It's one of the chasadim that they do in the community is to issue non-interest-bearing loans. And this is a mitzvah to do not only to a person who's indigent and poor, but even to someone who's wealthy but is otherwise illiquid. The Shulchan Aruch over here writes, "Ois Aleph, afil asher shetzarach la'avosa la'halvos mitzvah la'avosa." If there's an asher who needs a loan in order to get him through some sort of situation, there's a mitzvah to lend him the money. And the sma derives from the blanket language of the pasuk, which is im kesef talve es ami midikasef stam es ami, from the fact that the pasuk states without stipulation or without any caveats or exclusions that you have to lend other Jews money without interest. The presumption is that it includes not only the ani, not only the poor man, but the usher as well. And if a person does lend money without interest, that is a great chesed, as we already said. And in that sense, perhaps it's even greater than tzedakah. The Gemara over here in Masechta Sukkah explains that there are three ways that gemilas chasadim is greater than tzedakah. On the one hand, tzedakah can only be performed with money. Gemilas chasadim is bein begufo bein b'mamonai. So if a person lends money, he's doing gemilas chesed with his money. In that sense, it's similar to tzedakah. But gemilas chasadim also applies more than tzedakah. In a certain sense, it's better or advantageous, because tzedakah is only to those who are poor or indigent, as opposed to gemilas chasadim that applies even to those who are wealthy. If a person grants a loan, which doesn't involve any kind of interest, even to an otherwise wealthy person, he'll be in fulfillment of gemilas chasadim, bein begufa, which applies bein begufa, bein b'mamonai. Okay, so there's a wonderful opportunity to do a mitzvah of lending money without interest to someone who is in need of it, regardless of their otherwise financial situation. That obligation, though, to lend money without interest is offset or is counterbalanced by another often overlooked mitzvah, which is to pay back loans. Here, the Gemara says in Masechta Ksuvos, "Prias balchoy mitzvah." So there is a mitzvah to lend. There is also, it doesn't get as much celebration, but there is also a mitzvah to pay back loans. Where is that derived from? So Rashi there offers what I think is a surprising explanation. Rashi says the reason why is because the pasuk says in Parashas Kedoshim, "Eifa sedek v'hin sedek." You have to have honest weights and measures. An eifa is a measurement. Hin is also a measurement. both have to be honest. But once the Eifa has to be honest, obviously the Hin has to be honest. So why would I, why do I need the second example in the Pasuk? Rashi quotes from the Gemara, that it's because, it's coming to teach us an additional lesson, that your, not Hin, Hin is a measurement, but your Hain, your yes, should be a yes, your no should be a no. If you say you're going to pay back something, you should follow through on your word. You should do that which you committed to do. And if a person doesn't do that, the Pasuk says in Sefer Tehillim, Loive Rasha lo yishalim, that if a person doesn't borrow and doesn't pay back, he's a Rasha. But that's it. You know, he's a Rasha, because he said he was going to do something and he didn't do it. I would have said the reason why I have to pay back loans is because otherwise you're a ganif. You're a thief. You borrowed money under the assumption that you were going to pay it back. If you don't pay it back, you're withholding money that doesn't belong to you. However, and that's indeed how the Radvaz writes. The Radvaz writes in the Tshuva, person doesn't pay back a loan, he's a ganif. Rashi doesn't say that, and I believe that Rashi is l'shitasli. Rashi believes that that's not called a ganif. The fact that I didn't pay back money that I owe, that doesn't make me a ganif. If I go into your house and I take something that doesn't belong to me, or you give me something to watch and I don't return it, I hold on to the item which is otherwise yours, so then that's a ganif, because I stole something from you that's tangible. By not paying back a debt, a loan, I didn't steal anything. I owe you money and I'm not paying you, but you can't call me a ganif. Rashi writes like that over here, Masechta Sanhedrin, the Mishnah there says, Dine mamonis b'shloisha, gzeres v'chavolis b'shloisha. In order to adjudicate, huh?
What do you consider?
You're a bad guy. You're not a ganif. And Rashi reads this into the Mishnah. I'll get to your question in a second. The Mishnah there says, Dine Mamanis Bishloisha, Gzeus Vechavalos Bishloisha. In order to adjudicate Dine Mamanis, you need three. Gzeus Vechavalos, damages or theft, also three. 1 minute. Dine Mamanis is three, Gzeus Vechavalos is three. What is Dine Mamanis if not Gzeus Vechavalos, if not damages and theft? So the Gemara there explains it's hoidos v'halvos, admissions and loans. Meaning, if a person issues a loan and someone else is not paying back, or he feels he's not paying back, then you know you also require three dayanim. But from the fact that the Mishnah treats them in two separate line items, one is hoidos v'halvos, or in the language of the Mishnah, dine mamonis, the other is gzeilos v'chavolos, that implies that gzeilos and halvos are not the same thing, and a person who is delinquent and paying back a loan is not, in fact, a thief. And Rashi writes like that in his parish over there in the Gemara Masechta Sanhedrin. So Rashi feels that gzeilah is limited to stealing a tangible item that either was placed in my care or under my, I'm supposed to watch it, or I go into your house and steal something. But the fact that I don't pay back money that I owe does not make me a thief. It's still the right thing to do. Priyas Balchot Mitzvah doesn't make you a thief. The Radvaz disagrees, but obviously you have to read that Gemara Masechta Sanhedrin differently. But either way, you're a bad guy if you don't pay back, and Priyas Balchot is certainly a mitzvah. So while there is a mitzvah to lend money without interest, we should also not forget, in the course of that discussion, the mitzvah to pay back loans. Yeah.
What would be the bigger deal would be that maybe, okay, he lost the money, but nobody's ever going to want to give out a loan again if you're never going to pay back. If you never... There's no repercussions for...
You're talking about on a communal level. We should encourage people to pay back loans because otherwise no one's going to lend money.
That maybe be the reason why it isn't. So because then nobody's ever going to give back loans. So
you're saying it's just self-serving. But beyond that, no. Religiously it's required, independently. Not just because of the repercussions, you know, in terms of the credit industry. But, people won't lend money otherwise. Forget about the free flow of credit. Because it's the right thing to do. Yeah.
What about someone goes bankrupt? Does Judaism
ever
cancel out that loan?
They have a whole share with this, yeah, bankruptcy. Yeah, I think we discussed bankruptcy. Oh, 2 years ago. I'm blending years, but I said it's out there. I said bankruptcy. Halacha does recognize the bankruptcy, but only because of Dina the Malchus Dina. So we don't have our own independent mechanism for bankruptcy, but since the marketplace, the secular marketplace, the government imposes rules of bankruptcy in order to spur economic growth and encourage people to take risks and start new businesses. So because that's kind of the rules of the road, and that's the assumption of anybody who engages in business today, is that there is, you know, they have that fallback, and that's for the betterment of society. That would be one of the instances we filed Dina the Malchus Dina. That's what Moshe's a true was Moshe about it. But Halacha independently doesn't have its own mechanism. There's no allowance for bankruptcy in the eyes of Halacha.
What about like Rosh Hashanah time when you cancel out, you say your malchus all the loans that you've given?
That's Shemitah. Shemitah's suffering at the end of the Shemitah year, yeah.
That's
the exact reason Hillel established the Prizbol, so that people should not have loans canceled at the end of Shemitah's suffering, yeah. But that's not every year. I don't think most banks cancel mortgages at the every Rosh Hashanah.
Yeah, I could,
to
me, that was just not remembering what the thing is correctly, yeah. But what about when you have like three
Edom
around you?
That's Hataras Nadar. That's a separate thing. We'll get back to that though in a minute, but okay. Anyway, so there is a mitzvah to issue non-interest-bearing loans, and it's a beautiful mitzvah, and a person who was able to do so was encouraged to do so, but just and never forget also the mitzvah to pay back those loans with P.S. Baal Chayv Mitzvah. However, today, there are some who are able to do so, you know, and able to issue non-interest-bearing loans, and that's you know, a great mitzvah, but many, investment strategy doesn't allow them to do that, since we don't have the ability to do it, and they need to earn some sort of return on their money in order to have a parnasa. So because of that, there was an instrument, a halachic device that was developed called the Heter Iska, which again converts what would otherwise be a loan, an interest-bearing loan, into an investment that produces profits or dividends. In order to understand the mechanics of that, though, we first have to explain, really identify what are the features that are unique to a loan, and then to know to avoid them when crafting what would otherwise, you know, be categorized or classified as an investment, right? So we have to understand the differences, the contours of each, in order to avoid stepping over the line and becoming a loan. So the Gemara raises a fascinating suggestion in the name of Rabbi Chama, which actually is quite compelling, which is, 1 minute, I could lend out my shovel, I could rent out my lawnmower, I could rent out my house, I could rent out my car, and each time I'm entitled to take a fee. A fee, if you want to rent my car, it's going to cost you this many dollars a day or a month or a week, whatever. So I'm entitled to, you know, to claim a rental fee. How come I can't rent out $1,000 and collect a rental fee? We won't call it a loan with interest. We'll call it a rental with a rental fee. That was a suggestion that was made by Rabbi Chama. In fact, Rabbi Chama over here, the Gemara tells him, "Sechus b'mitzia havi moiger zuzi b'pshita." He would rent out a zuz b'pshita for an eighth of a zuz. So he would collect an eighth of a zuz as a rental fee for a zuz, and he figured that was not a violation of ribbis. Biyuma kule zuzi. He lost all of his money, meaning Hashgacha saw to it that he was unsuccessful in his endeavors and his wealth diminished or disappeared. Obviously, he made a mistake here. What did he do wrong? Why is this different than any other rental? We're entitled to collect a fee. He was wrong. It's because a rental item is returned and intact. And there's some wear and tear. You return a shovel, there's wear and tear, so you're entitled to collect a rental fee. You return a lawnmower, so there's, you return the same lawnmower that you borrowed, and there's some, wear and tear, so you're entitled to collect a rental fee for those losses. And anyway, it's the item that, that you lent out that you're getting back. As opposed to a loan, zuzi, or renting out money, loy hadra beinayu voyidia pachse. The money over here is not getting returned intact. Money is fungible. So you're going to lend one money or rent one money, and he's going to return to you not those dollar bills, but its worth or its equivalent in other dollar bills. So you don't get exactly what you rented out in return. You cannot call that, a rental. That is by definition considered to be a loan. So if you don't return the same item that you, receive back the same item that you lent out, or the same item that you rented out, you can't call that a rental. Rental means you get exactly what you gave out. That's exactly the same item that you get back. Over here, milva lahitzanitna, the loan is meant to be spent, and someone's going to return to you its worth in value. But since you don't get the same item return that you lent out, you can't call that a rental. By definition, it's going to be called a loan. Yeah.
Isn't the concept by money, though, that it's all interchangeable? It's all like the same thing? Like,
correct. That's the definition of a loan, though. You can't call it a rental. Rental. Rav Chama had a great, different structure which we could use instead of a loan. Forget about business investments. Let's call every loan a rental. Let's call every loan a rental. You're renting $1,000, so you can't. Says the Gemara, you can't. Rav Chama thought that was a good argument.
Same object?
Because it's not the same object that's returned.
So if you lend somebody a lawnmower and then give them back exactly the same,
a different lawnmower, like that wouldn't be called a rental. That wouldn't be called a rental.
So
yeah.
What is that? Purchasing and buying something else?
Okay. Yeah. But with money, we're going to call it a loan. Yeah. So you can't escape that classification of a loan and avoid sidestep ribbis by doing so. Yeah. Yeah.
What was regarding inflation or deflation?
Right. So we've discussed this before also, that money in the eyes of halacha never changes value. That commodities change in value and fluctuate and go up and down. currency always stays the same. Whatever currency is established in that country, for that country, that currency is always stable. The dollar happens to be the universal currency, at least for now. So that's throughout the world has some stability to it. However,
the inflation is considered the wear and tear on the.
No, in the eyes of halakha, currency never fluctuates in value. That's why you can borrow $1,000 and pay back $1,000. You cannot borrow 1,000 soda cans and pay back 1,000 soda cans because soda cans fluctuate in value. That's what's known as sub-asa. It's a potential violation of ribis, certainly ribis derabanan, because borrowing soda cans. 2 days later, soda cans might go up from 75 cents to $1.25 or something, and now you're returning something of greater value than what you borrowed. So, why don't we concern the same thing with the dollar? The dollar always fluctuates in value in reference or, you know, in contrast to other currencies. The answer is, in the eyes of halacha, this is not the way, obviously, the currency markets work, but in the eyes of halacha, currency always remains stable. We talked about this with regards to digital currencies. What's the status of Bitcoin? Is that of a status of currency or does that fluctuate in value? Anyway, Kitzer, yeah, getting back. So that's the difference between a rental versus a loan. A loan, you return something, not the item that you lent out. You get something else back, different money, and therefore that's by definition a loan and not considered to be a rental. Rashi there, though, explains another difference between a rental and a loan, and that is with a rental, the owner bears responsibility. Let's say the renter is using the car and an onus happens to the car, which is beyond his control. He doesn't bear responsibility. That's the owner's responsibility. Or let's say it dies. The car breaks as he's using it. Mesa machmas malacha. Whose responsibility is that? That's the owner's responsibility. He bears the loss, not the renter. As opposed to a loan, if I issue a loan, all of the responsibility is borne by the borrower. So over here in this situation, if you rented out your money, Rabbi Chama rented out his zuzeh bepachse, so then who bore the responsibility in that situation? The potential loss, if it got, you know, went down, the risk was borne by the borrower or by the renter and not by the owner. And in that situation where the risk is borne by the borrower or by, you know, the person who's renting, that is different fundamentally than, that is why it's considered to be a loan as opposed to a typical rental where the responsibility, at least in the case of onus or case of mesa machmas malacha, will be borne by the owner. So who bears the risk here is also a defining quality feature of loans versus rentals. A rental, not only do we return the same item intact, which doesn't exist by a loan, but another difference is who bears the risk if it gets lost. So in a typical rental, some of the risk is borne by the owner as opposed to in a loan where the risk is borne completely by the borrower. Yeah. That's if he does. Well, you're talking about and how you rent a bike on if you go bicycling on the beach. In halacha, the rent, there's no such thing as a security deposit that's required for a rental. That I could do something to protect myself because I do bear some of the risk. I could take whatever measures I want to protect myself. But fundamentally, in the eyes of halacha, a soicher is the same as a shomer sachar. So he's chayiv b'gnei v'aved, he's chayiv b'mshia. But he's not chayiv if it's an oynes or it's mesa machmas malacha. That's only a shoyl is chayiv in oynes mesa machmas malacha. A soicher, a renter, is not. So some of the responsibility is borne by the owner. In a loan, none of the responsibility is borne by the lender. It's all borne by the borrower. So in that sense over here, where he lent out or rented out his money, the sense of responsibility was borne by the borrower, or the renter, that cannot be considered a rental. A rental, by definition, the responsibility is borne by the owner. So some of the risk, the who bears the risk, is also a defining feature of a loan versus a rental. But just coming back now to an investment versus a loan, so one of the primary differences will be who bears the risk. In a loan, the risk is borne by the borrower. He bears all of the risk, as opposed to, he's got to pay back no matter what, as opposed to an investment where the risk is borne by the investor, by the owner. If I invest money with you and you lose the money, that's my loss. That's my loss. So who bears the risk is one defining difference between an investment versus a loan. But another difference is mentioned over here by the Mishnah Maseches Bava Metzia, and that is whether or not there's a guaranteed return. In a loan, there's a guaranteed return. In an investment, the returns are not guaranteed. There is no guaranteed dividend or profit. That's the aspiration, and that's why you're investing in this venture in the first place, but it's not guaranteed. The Mishnah says over here, "A mekablin soim barzel miYisrael." You cannot accept a guaranteed investment, meaning that I say to you, here, I'm investing money with you, But you bear the responsibility and you owe me a 5% return, you know, annually, whatever. You cannot, it's an investment. I'm giving you to legitimately to invest, but the terms of the investment are that you bear the responsibility and you promise me a certain return, or you promise me a return. So then that is considered to be a ribis and will be prohibited. Rashi there writes, if you don't mention what the return will be, then it's avak ribis. It's ribis derabanan. Tosfos adds, but if you mention a rate of return, that in fact would be ribis deraisa. So even though it's phrased as a, or described as an investment, it might legitimately be so if all of the responsibility is borne by the manager, the one who receives the investment, and he guarantees a rate of return that is too similar to a loan, and therefore is considered to be ribis. So the difference between a loan versus, you know, a rental is returned intact. The same thing that you rent out is the thing you receive in return. As opposed to a loan, you receive different monies. But a loan versus an investment, the defining qualities are who bears the risk and is there a guaranteed return. In a loan, all the risk is borne by the borrower. If he loses it, you know, it doesn't matter. He still has to pay back the loan and he guarantees a rate of return. As opposed to an investment, there is no guaranteed rate of return. You hope and, you know, and pray for profits and dividends, but you don't know that it will happen. And the risk is borne by the investor. By the investor. If the manager loses the money, so then, you know, that's the investor's problem. Yeah.
So a rental and an investment are the same thing?
No, different structures, and they each differentiate themselves from a loan in different ways. But though these are the defining qualities of a loan.
Basically, we have the rental.
The rental versus the loan, right? A rental is returned intact. The loan is not. Milva leitza nei. No. Another difference is who bears responsibility, and that is another that is one of the first differences between a loan and an investment, is who bears responsibility, and also whether there's a guaranteed rate of return.
Each has two differences.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. So Chazal, though, did approve of a following structure, and the reason why we need their approval is because it's we understand that it's somewhere on the line, and that's mentioned over here by the Gemara Bava Metzia, Kuvdal Mabez, what's known as an iska. Amina Adoy, high iska, there is such a structure known as an iska, which is permitted, which is palga milvo palga bikada. Now what this means is that it doesn't have to be half and half. What it means is, what is permitted, and this Chazal did allow, is if, let's say, you want to manage money, you have a good venture that you want to invest in, you encourage me, you recruit money from me, you're syndicating money from me. So I say, look, you know, I don't want to bear all the risk over here, you know, and I want to make sure that I'm not completely exposed. So I say to you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to lend you half the money as a loan. That, you have to pay me back no matter what. You're also going to invest it in this venture, but I'm loaning it to you and I want that back. The other half, or whatever percentage we decide, 25, 75, whatever works for us, I'm willing to invest as a pikadon. Pikadon means I'm putting it in your hands to manage on my behalf. And I'm also investing in this venture. So I'm going in the venture, you're going in the venture. We both have skin in the game. We both have some exposure to risk. You know, you're going to invest the money that I loaned you, which you have to pay me back no matter what. And then I have some risk because I'm giving you money to invest in the venture, and I bear the losses if the venture does not pan out. That way, the risk is borne somewhat by both. Now, why does that require a heter? Why does Chazal have to create this structure and say that that's allowed? Because it's a little bit complicated. Because I'm loaning you money, and then together with the loaning you money, you're managing my money in this venture, in this account. So you're managing my money, which also, you know, it goes along with the fact, or is because of the fact that I loaned you money to invest in the venture. That is a little bit akin to ribis. You're doing a favor for me because I loaned you money. And in fact, the Mishnah says over here in Maseches Bava Metzia that because of that, I have to pay you a nominal token fee for managing my money. The Mishnah here describes, Ein moshivin chen v'nei lumech sischar. What that means is, I cannot provide you with inventory. 50% of it will be mine. 50% of it I'm loaning to you, which you're going to have to pay me back for. I'm going to ask that we split the profits, right? Let's say you want to open a store. You have no capital to stock your store. So I provide you with inventory, I provide you with capital to buy the inventory. I say half of it will belong to me, you know, and you're managing it for me. If it goes down or gets lost, it's my loss. Half of it I'm loaning to you that I expect you to pay me back. So the Mishnah says you can't do that, or the person can't manage your inventory for free. You have to pay him a token nominal amount for managing your money. Otherwise, that is precisely ribis. He is doing this favor for you, managing your half of the investment because you loaned him the other half. So you have to pay him a token fee. It doesn't have to be a great amount or even market value for managing money, but I have to pay him a token fee to remove it from the problem of ribis. But this kind of arrangement where it's half pikadon, half malveh, or part malveh, part pikadon, where I, you know, pass off some of the exposure, some of the risk to you. You guarantee to pay me back without interest. Be guaranteed to pay me back. But you also, I'm going to invest in the same venture, and you're going to manage my money for me, provided that I give you a little bit of schar, a dollar, let's say, to manage that money. So then, you know, that would be an acceptable structure. That's what's known as an iska, and that's going to be the framework for the heter iska. We're not completely there yet. This structure doesn't have to be simultaneous. It could even be sequential. That's what it says over here in the Shulchan Aruch. Simin Kuf Samach Zayin Sif Aleph. Kuf Ayin Zayin Sif Beis and Gimel is that structure that we just mentioned. But then you can have it in the reverse, which is Kuf Samach Zayin Sif Aleph, which is where I say, you know what, I'm going to give you all of the money as an investment. You manage my investment for me. Let's say it's $100. When it reaches a certain dividend, a certain profit threshold, $200, it will convert into a loan. Now I want, no matter what, my $200 back. So you're going to manage it at $100 till it gets to $200. That's a pikavon. That's an investment. The risk is on me, and you're working for me. I'm going to have to pay you for that. But then, after it reaches $200, you know, you're only doing this because you hope to get, you know, the money from me as an investment into your, you know, into your investment. That money, though, I want back no matter what. It converts into a malva. So it was a pikavon. It was an investment that then later on converts into a loan. So instead of being side by side, simultaneously, part loan, part investment, it starts out as an investment and then transfers into a loan, or starts out as a loan and then is converted into an investment. The Vilna Gaon is not happy with this structure. The Vilna Gaon does not like this. Over here at the end of Vayis Yud, because he feels at all times it has to be a pikadon and a milva together. If at any point in time it becomes completely a loan, then it looks too much like a loan and interest, and you're giving me back more money than I lent you. So the Gaon is not happy with this. He believes that it's better always to be simultaneously chatzi milva bechatzi pikadon, and that was, because of the Gaon's objection, that was the formula that was instituted in the heter iska. At this point enters the heter iska. But what is the kunz of the heter iska? So the heter iska was, this is a structure that's already mentioned by Chazal. This, you know, structure of investment is viable and acceptable. However, at the end of the 1500s, 1599, there was a Rav in Krakow. We don't know that much about him. He's known as Rav Mendel Avigdors. Now, we know that he was a great Goyim because the other Goyim of the time, the great Gedolim of the time, interacted with him and corresponded with him. The Sma, who's a commentary on the side of Shulchan Aruch, not in Yoredeya, in Chayshim Mishpat, wrote a whole kuntris, Hilchas Ribbis is, of course, in Yoredeya, wrote a whole kuntris on this heter iska that was devised by Rav Mendel Avigdors, who's a Rav in Krakow, in response to him, and they worked out some of the kinks and the details together. So he was corresponding with the Sma, with the Levush, with the Bach, with all of the Gedolim at the time, and they treated him with great respect. So he was clearly a great Goyin. We don't know that much about him, but other than the fact that he is the one who devised the heter iska. It's known as the heter iska of the Maram. Why would the Maram? Morenu Harav Rav Mendel. So Morenu Harav Rav Mendel Maram. So the heter iska is known as Takanas Maram. He created this device known as the heter iska, and after he worked out the kinks together with the Sma, the Bach, the Levush, it's already quoted on the side of Shulchan Aruch and the Shach and the Taz, this structure that he laid out. The kunst, though, of the heter iska, again, which converts loans into investments, is the Trumas Hadeshim. Because this heter iska, or this iska, which we've been discussing until now, really is not satisfactory for the investor. What does the investor want, or the person who lends money? He wants no risk, or minimal risk, and guaranteed profits, right? Guaranteed returns. That's hard to create outside of a loan bearing, you know, interest bearing loan. So how can we have a business structure which has no exposure, minimal risk, and guaranteed rate of return? So even the ISCA relationship, there is risk, right? Half of it you accept as a milveh, but the other half is on me. If the investment goes down and tanks, I lose half. The other problem is there's no guaranteed rate of return. We hope the investment, the venture, is successful, but I don't know that there's going to be profits and dividends. So again, it's a risky undertaking. However, there's the kunz of the heter iska is not the maram, was not Rav Mendel Avigdors. It was created really by the Trumas Hadeshin in a different context. He took that kernel of an idea and he put it into the heter iska. What is that kernel of an idea? That idea of the Trumas Hadeshin is that the following is permissible. What I can do is I can invest money with you, and then, of course, I bear the risk. But what I can say to you is, I'm investing with you. You didn't tell me the investment went down. I want witnesses, and I lost all my money. I want you to provide me with witnesses that the investment went down and I lost all my money. Meaning that you managed it properly. You did everything, Kedasu Kedin, as we had agreed. and you invested in the venture that we had talked about, you said it lost all its money. I need witnesses who testify to the fact that you lost all the money. And I can specify which witnesses I want. I could say I want witnesses from Iceland and Hong Kong to testify about this venture that we had over here. That they say you invested it properly and you lost all your money. That's an impossibility. There's no way that's ever going to happen. So the Sma, in adjusting, in his conversations with the Maharam, said, come on, that's too far. You can't ask the guy to have witnesses that have no possibility of ever appearing. However, what you can ask him to do is have witnesses that could possibly appear, could possibly know about the, you know, or verify the goings-on of this transaction, but who are unlikely to know. So what ended up happening was that they said, the Maharam, Tachanas Maharam, is I could say, you said my venture went down, we lost all our money, I want witnesses to that effect, and I specify those witnesses as the Rav and the Shatz in the community. Why? Because the Rav and the Shatz in the community could, in theory, appear, the Rav and the Chazan. It's unlikely that they know about the particulars of any, you know, individual's business, so they're not likely to be able to testify that the, you know, that the business lost all of its, you know, all of its money. But it's reasonable, but not likely. So what I can say is, you know what? If you want to testify, or you're going to demand, you're going to claim that you lost all the money, I demand that you bring these two witnesses to testify to that effect. And you claim there was no profits. You claim you weren't profitable in the investment that I gave you. Well, I want you to bring witnesses to the fact that there were no profits, that the Shatz and the Rav should testify that there's no profits. So again, here, the Smal, the Levush, and the Bach felt that was too far. There's no way he's going to bring witnesses to whether or not it was profitable or not. But what you can ask him to do is take a Shvua Chamura. I can ask him to take a Shvua, and I can, you know, scare him in terms of taking Shvua. Their call is scary in terms of the punishment for taking a false swear. But I could even make him do it in the shul with candles and in the dark and make it spooky. And I could, you know, to Bein Ashrei Uvalitzion while the Sefer Torah is out. I can make him take a Shvua when it's scary to swear to the fact that there were no profits. Ah, you're not going to be able to produce those witnesses that you have losses. You're not going to be able to produce a Shvua that you had no profits. What I am willing to do is to be meichel my claim. I'm willing to settle my claim of profits that I want back from our business undertaking that we made together. I'm willing to take a 5% rate of return in lieu of and settle my claim. So let's say, again, we engage in an iska. An iska is a chatzi milva v'chatzi pikodin. Half of it is a loan, half of it is an investment. That minimizes my risk and exposure because you have to return to me half. You agree to invest in the same venture, and I have a possibility for profit in return. But I want a guaranteed profit in return. So what I say to you is, You know, when you come back to me in a year, you might claim that you lost all the money, you might claim that there's no profits, and I'm entitled to nothing. I say, no, you better swear to me that there are no profits. Oh, you don't want to swear? You're too scared to swear? What I'm willing to take is demei hispashrus, not interest. What I'm willing to take is a settlement amount, either in a fixed amount, like $1,000, or a rate of return for however long you held on to my money. So the shach over here writes, it doesn't have to be a set amount. It could even be a specific rate of return. That is allowed. And that will get you out of having to take the shvua. So the way the deal was structured, and this is the heter iska of the Maharam, is that it's a iska, chatzi milva v'chatzi pikadon. Part of the risk is borne by me. Part of the risk is borne by you. I have to pay you for managing my money, a nominal and token fee, about $1. And then when it comes time to, you know, give me the profits from the investment, my share of the profits, which I'm entitled to half and you're entitled to half. So you're going to tell, if you could potentially tell me there are no profits available, I'm going to ask you to take a shavua. You don't want to take a shavua. So then I'll say I'm willing to take this rate of return in lieu of a shavua and I'll settle my claim. And that's how I'm able to protect myself from any risk, because you're not going to be able to bring witnesses that the investment went down. And I guaranteed a rate of return. I locked in a rate of return because you're not going to want to take a shvua to swear to me that you had no profit. So that was how the Maharam kind of removed any risk and secured a rate of return. Today, some Jews might happily take a shvua. They're not scared of Sifrei Torah. Maybe they're lacking in Yerushalayim. Maybe they're not from Bechlal. So the heter iska is not going to impact them in the proper way. So that's why in Eretz Yisrael, there's some Paiskim who suggested today that instead of asking him to take a shvua, we should ask him to say, if you want to claim, you would put in our agreement in the heter iska, if you want to claim that there are no profits, you will have to undergo a forensic accounting of the investment from the beginning to the end and your involvement and whether or not you conducted it according to the, you know, the terms of our arrangement. No one wants to undergo a forensic accounting, certainly if this is the end deal or all of their other deals, and therefore that it will serve as a sufficient deterrent to encourage him to take the settlement amount, which is locking in a rate of return. So if I say that's how the heter iska, that's how the heter iska works. There is another variant of the heter iska. The problem with this arrangement is that, again, how this works is we're going to split the returns. I'm supposed to get half the returns of the investment, half the dividends. You claim there are no dividends, so then you pay me, instead of, I say, you have to take a shvuah to that effect. You don't want to take a shvuah, so you pay me a settlement amount, you know, in lieu of that. But, at least in theory, right, if the profits that I have to, or I wanted to gain out of this arrangement, would have to have been enough that if we could have split it, I could have gotten a sufficient rate of return. Let's say the rate of return I would like is 15%. Interest rates are high, late 70s, right? So this deal, who gets the profits? We're supposed to split the profits. Chatzi milva v'chatzi pikodan. So we're supposed to split the profits. That means that if I want to lock in a rate of return of 15%, that's the demei hispashus, that's the settlement amount, because that's the going interest rate that I could get in the bond market, right? In the Fed. So then this deal would have to throw off 30% in order to reasonably ask for a 15% return, because you also have to give 15%. So in order for me to ask for 15% rate of return, the deal has to, in theory, be able to throw off 30%. Very few deals can throw off such a high rate of return. So when interest rates are low, the chatzi mil of chatzi pikadon works very well. When interest rates are higher, the plausibility of the arrangement from the very beginning is suspect. So this arrangement could be phrased not as a chatzi mil of chatzi pikadon, the whole thing could be called a pikadon, meaning I could say the whole thing is an investment. I'm putting all my money by you. You're managing the money. I'm going to pay you $1 for managing. I'm going to pay you $1 for managing the money. And I could say, you know what? And I'll even, I'll give you a share of the profits instead of paying you $1. By the way, I could always cut you in for a higher share of the profits. We were supposed to split it 50-50. Instead, I could say, as a fee for managing my money, I'm going to give you an extra 5% return. So it should have been 45-55. I'll take 45. You take 55 because you're managing it. And anyway, you have a 50% stake. So what I could say is, if the whole thing is a pikadon, then I'm willing to give you a certain rate of return for managing the money. And phrase it as a kula pikadon. And then when you come back to me and you say, I didn't earn any money and the money was lost because the investment went down, I could say either bring aidin to the fact the money was lost or take a shvua to me that you have no profits, you're not going to want to take a shvua, so you'll pay the demei hispashus. So it could be phrased, it could be structured in a number of different ways, but that's the basic structure. That's the heter iska. Everybody understand how it works? Not that complicated. There is a blind spot, though. There's a blind spot. What's the blind spot? What happens over here is I'm set. You come to me. I invested with you. You come to me. You say, "Oh, I lost the money. The investment went down, or there were no returns." So I say, "I don't believe you. Take a shvuah that there were no returns." You don't want to take a shvuah. So instead, you're going to pay me demei hispashus, a settlement fee, either whatever rate of return we lock in. And this is structured as investment, and you're paying me a settlement fee instead of having to pay me the true profits or losses of the. Of the business, or take a shvuah that there were losses. However, let's say the loan wasn't taken for investment purposes. The loan was taken, for personal use. I know the loan was taken for personal use. There is no prospect of profits here. I know, you know, there's no prospect for profits. And it's worse, let's say, but you never know. Maybe he asked for it for personal use and he's going to use it for something else. So the Paiskim debated, do we say maybe he uses it for, diverts the money for something else, even though he asked me for it for personal use? Can I issue a heter iska when he says it's not for investment purposes? Right, if it's really for an investment, you don't need a heter iska. That's an investment. If this, the heter iska is necessary where it should have been normally structured as a loan because it's for personal use. Can I really say if he asked me for personal use that I asked him to take a shvul that there were no profits? He never suggested there would be profits. So it works if it's a business loan. If it's a personal loan, it's much harder. So here the person that we're willing to be lenient, because you never know. I put money in his pocket. You don't know what people end up doing. Maybe he went to Atlantic City and he made a killing. Who knows? Who knows? Unlikely, but who knows? Yeah, but it gets worse. What about in a loan where he never sees the money? He never has it in his pocket. Where do you have a loan where he never has it in his pocket? A mortgage. A bank. It writes a check to the seller of the house. They don't want to give it to the buyer of the house. He could take the few $100,000 that he's taking as a mortgage and blow it at the blackjack table. They want to make sure that their money is going to the house. So they issue the check directly to the seller. It never goes to the hands of the buyer. Or a student loan. Student loan goes from one pocket of the university to the other pocket of the university. You never see the cash. never see the cash, but there is a rate of return. So how can you have a heter iska if the person never even had the cash in their pocket or a margin account? I open up an investment account to invest with borrowed money. The money never came into my hand. It's managed by the investment firm, the house, the whole time. So how could you even say that I took the money and diverted it to invest in something that was profitable? There's no way. I never even saw the money. So in these kinds of situations, very difficult, very difficult. How can I ask you to take a shavua? Everyone knows it didn't profit. There's no way it profited. Or Rabbi should discuss the case. Let's say you told me you're investing in a certain stock. We all know you invest in a stock. You invest in a certain property. The property went under. I know the property went under. It's in the newspapers. Frank's, you know, story in the Wall Street Journal. This property, which I invested in, went down. How can I ask you to take a shavua? There were no profits. We all saw in the newspaper there were no profits. So that's why the later Achorinim added another provision to the Takan of the Maram to account for this blind spot. And that is that what I say in the heter iska is that in lieu of the fact that I am investing money with you or loaning part of the money to you, chatzi milu v'chatzi pikadon, the manager is makne to the investor not only his share of this venture that they're undertaking together, but a portion of all of his other profitable investments. And those profitable investments will, you know, be also partially, you know, he'd be entitled to receive profits from those other investments as well. So then when the manager comes to the investor and he says, you know what I invested in, and that there's no way that made money, now the investor can say to him, whoa, 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 but I have a share in some of your other ventures too. Did those make money that I'm entitled to a share, a portion of those profits? And now I can ask you to take a shavua on those other profitable ventures that you do have. So even though I know this venture we undertook together was not profitable because I see where the money went, or we all know that it wasn't profitable, but you never asked me for it for investment purposes. If you have other investments, I can ask for a share in those investments, and now I'm entitled to profits for that. You're not going to want to take a shavua that you have no profits to share with me, and in lieu of taking the shavua, I'm willing to settle for the demei hispashrus, the rate of return that we agreed upon. That's great. Fantastic. Lumdus. The problem is, Rabbi say, what if the guy comes with his hat in hand? He has no other profitable investments. He's coming to pay off chayvis in Eretz Yisrael. Chayvis. He's paying off his chayvis. He's paying off chasanas. This guy doesn't have, money market accounts. He doesn't have other investments. So here, where the person is asking for it as a personal loan, and particularly where it's linked to a specific, you know, chayv that he's going to pay off, or a house, like something like that, and there's no way this person has other investments, here the Paiskim are very hesitant to allow the heter iska. And they say for Teres Haribis, they quote from Rabbi Yashiv, in those situations, the heter iska is a little bit shaky, because there's no way. How can I ask him to take a shvua, and instead of taking a shvua, he's going to issue me the demei hispashrus, the settlement amount. He has no possibility for profitability. How could I possibly ask him to take a shvua in the first place? So Rabbi Yashiv was a little bit hesitant, and another Paiskim as well, hesitant to allow heter iska in that setting. However, the Teres Haribis quotes from Shlomo Zalman that it can be allowed. Can be allowed, despite that fact, it can be allowed. Because you never know, Yeshua Hashem Karafayim, maybe he got Yerusha from somewhere, maybe a unique opportunity presented itself. So even though the guy was on Skid Row 2 minutes before, you never know, maybe another opportunity presented itself. And what I'm asking him to do is to take a shvua that no other opportunities presented themselves which were profitable for him, which I would be entitled to a chelik of, because he not only was makter to me a chelik of the investment, the venture that I loaned him the money for, that I invested the money with him for, but he was makter to me a chelik in other profitable ventures, either that he has at the time or that he might have in the future. So Shlomo Zalman held that I could ask him to take a shavua. Once I could ask him to take a shavua, he's not going to want to take a shavua. And in order to avoid the shavua, he'll pay me. He agrees to pay me the demei hispashrus, the settlement amount that we arranged beforehand. So that's how it would have to be structured. Because it's so important to have the risk, and people, Jews were engaging in lending money all the time, and many of them were not availing themselves of the proper method of the heter iska. So in the 1920s, there was a grandson of Rabbi Kiva Eger, the son of Rabbi Leibel Eger, named Rabbi Meir Azriel Eger. It was a Chassidish Rebbe in Lublin. Everyone knows, right? Rabbi Leibel Eger, Rabbi Kiva Eger's son, went to the Derech HaChassidus of Ishbitz and of Tzadik. So his descendants also maintained that allegiance to Chassidus. So he was a Rebbe in Lublin. So he came up with what he thought was a great takana. He printed in a sefer called Takanas Rabim that together with Hataras Nedarim and Erev Rosh Hashanah, we gather three people together, we're matu all our Nedarim, and we also declare a kol nidre, that all the Nedarim that I'm going to take in the following year should not be considered Nedarim. It's a Mesiros Maida. It's a disclaimer for all my statements in the coming year shouldn't be construed as a neder. So too, a person can make a mesiras moida on all of his business transactions, that they should all be considered an iska al pi takanas maram. Meaning all my transactions, even if not mentioned or stipulated as such at the time of the undertaking of the investment, they should all be based, or loan, or lending people money, should all be considered an iska based on the framework that was arranged by the maram. And in this way, you don't have to make a heter iska. This was the dawn of what's known as the heter iska klali. Everything I do is based upon the heter iska of the maram, and I don't have to mention it explicitly when we're, you know, with every specific venture. And the Imre Yemes, who was the Gay Rebbe at the time, praised this as a great takanas hatzibor. It would help many people avoid the problem of ribis in their business transactions by making a heter itza kloli, this mesiras maida disclaimer at the beginning of the year. Rabbi Zalman Meltzer, who was the father-in-law of Rabbi Aaron Cutler, and Rabbi Aaron Cutler wrote himself about it quite vociferously in his Tshuvas Mishnah to Rabbi Aaron, argued heavily against this heter itza kloli. Why? Why? Because it's unilateral. A heter iska means you and I enter into an arrangement with the understanding that this is a business investment as opposed to a loan. If I say it, but you don't know about it, how does that make a meeting of the minds between us that we understand what we're both getting ourselves into? And moreover, the guy at the beginning of the year says, oh, Hataras Nedarim. Most people have no idea how Hataras Nedarim works or what it's all about. They get in front of a few people and they just say it. Okay, but you guys going to say it over here by the heter. He doesn't know. All my transactions should be, you know, based on the heter iska of the maram. So Ramesha writes over here in the Igros Ramesha, the heter iska is not pixie dust that you throw at money and it exempts it from ribis. It's not some sort of skula or kamea or incantation or potion that you can drink or say and voila, you don't have any problem with ribis. That's not how it works. It's a financial arrangement that you have to, vehicle that you have to explicate, you have to describe so that we have a meeting of the minds over here and everyone understands what we are transacting. So Rav Moshe was also opposed to a heter iska klali. However, Rav Moshe himself endorsed the heter iska klali in a bank setting. He advised Rabbi Tamler how to set up a firm bank in Muncie, and he told him, make a heter iska klali. And there it is allowed. Rav Moshe explains that it's because when people go into a bank, you sign lots of documents that have to do with the bylaws and the procedures of the bank. And you sign off by default when you do business with a certain bank, to whatever terms and conditions they apply, given their bylaws and their, you know, whatever regulations they have. So if that's the case, if this bank says all of our business is conducted under heter iska klali, you have to sign up for it. You are, by definition, doing business with this bank. You understand that whatever bylaws and whatever terms and conditions they have, you are agreeing to it, whether you understand it or not. So that is part of the culture when you go into a bank. That is not necessarily the culture of two private individuals engaged in a business arrangement. So that's why heter iska klali on a private level, much more suspect. Some people do it as a safeguard, a safety net in case there's something wrong with their heter iska. But that's not really a way to do business. In a bank, that, you know, it is more valid. And every bank in Eretz Israel today, every bank has a heter iska klali through which they do business. Every bank structures it somewhat differently. You can find it. The banks in Eretz Israel are very transparent about their heter iskas. They want Jews, they will from Jews to do business with them. And each one is structured and worded somewhat differently based on their specific needs and sensitivities. But everybody does business. Banks routinely do business with a heter iska klali. This is the heter iska that was, mekubal, throughout. And it's discussed by the Shach, the Taz, the Takanas Maram. The Vilna Gaon in the Maisa Rav was opposed to it. Over here, the Vilna Gaon, Ois Yud Zayin, right? And again, there's no explanations in the Maisa Rav. It's just on Hagas of the Gra. He says, Ein heter berevachim klau. There's no such thing. You can't rely on a heter iska. Why? First of all, I understand. He was upending what was already an established practice at his time. He was in the 1700s. Maram was well before him. The heter iska of the Maram, even though he devised it at the end of the 1500s, the generation after the Ramah, who's the Rav in Krakow, it didn't appear in print, though, till the Nachla Shiva. The Nachla Shiva was printed by the son of the Taz, which is a standard collection of shtaris. Our Ksuba comes from the Nachla Shiva. All of our other, the Tnoim comes from the Nachla Shiva. The Nachla Shiva is a collection of shtaris. I'm sure in American law, there's also a book of boilerplate language for different arrangements and different situations. So this is the Nachla Shiva is the standard book of shtaris. So in the Nachla Shiva was the first time the Heter Isk of the Maram was printed. You can find it there in the Nachos Shiva, which is printed by the son of the Taz, about 100 years later in 1681. So the Gaon lived after that, and the Gaon was upending what was already printed in the textbook of Shtaris, was the Heter Iskei of the Maharam. Why was the Gaon opposed to it? So the Gaon, many explain that the Gaon over here was opposed to it because he understood that this was a subterfuge. This was a ruse. This was a halachic workaround around Ribbis. And therefore, he was opposed to it. It was known as a harama. Look over here. The Shulchan Aruch gives us the following situation. Simen Kuf Ayin Zayin Sif Yud Gimel. If, let's say, a person is a learning Rebbe for a Baal HaBos. Baal HaBos pays this melamed to teach his son. Then the Baal HaBos all of a sudden finds himself illiquid, and he needs a loan. Now, how could it be this poor melamed is going to lend money to the Baal HaBos? So it could happen very well. You know why? A melamed, where does he store his money? Under his pillow. So they have liquid cash, right? The Baal HaBos is invested heavily. He's leveraged. He doesn't have liquid assets. So he just needs it. He needs money for groceries. So he goes to the Malam. He says, you know, lend me $100. Yeah, short-term loan. So he lends him $100. But then he's going to now pay him, right, for learning with his son. So he's paying him. He's in his employ at the same time that the Malam lent him money. That looks a lot like Ribbis. The Malam lent him money. Now he's paying him to learn with his son. That's close to Ribbis. So Shachar says you can't do this. But what you can do is Malamed could give the Baal HaBos money as a matana, as a gift. No strings attached. And then the Malamed could pay him to learn with his son. Of course, though, the Baal HaBos could pay the Malamed to learn with his son. Of course, everyone understands this poor Malamed does not intend to give a gift to this rich Baal HaBos, and the rich Baal HaBos has no intention of taking a gift from the Malamed. It's a short-term arrangement. We're going to call it a gift, wink, wink, right? But, of course, it's a loan. Of course, it's a loan. So Shulchan Aruch allows that. Shulchan Aruch says, fine, you phrase it as a gift, it's allowed. The Gra is upset about it. The Gaon says, no, come on, this is a harama. You can't do this. And he quotes from the Rashba that haramas ribishu. It's a workaround, it's a farce, it's a fraud. And therefore, the Gra didn't allow it. Obviously, the fact that we allow the Heter Iskei, we endorse it, it's become institutionalized in the way we do business, shows the fact that we have accepted it. Rabbi said, we have a complicated relationship with haramas. Sometimes a harama is celebrated. Like if you have a Bechor Behemoth Tahira, you have the Bechor Behemoth Tahira is Kadosh. You can't do anything today, though, with a Bechor Behemoth Tahira. So you have to keep it. It's literally a holy cow. And you have to try and manage it without working it, without getting it. It's a nuisance. It's a halachic nuisance. So the best way to avoid it is to sell the animal to a guy before it gives birth. Then the animal that gives birth to the bechor is not kadosh, and I don't have to worry about it. And the Shulchan Aruch endorses that and celebrates it. That's the way to handle a bechor behemoth tahira, so you don't have any problems. That's a great harama, but it's a workaround. When it comes to selling chametz on Pesach, some are uncomfortable with it, some are comfortable with it. Deiraisa chametz, deirabbanan chametz. When it comes to selling a business for Shabbos, selling the land in Eretz Yisrael to avoid, you know, the Isurim of Shemitah, well, much more complex, right? So some haramis, some legal fictions or workarounds, devices or clevernesses, you know, are viewed with disdain. Some are viewed very positively, and some are, you know, more benign, or you have a neutral attitude to it. So over here, it seems to be a machlekes whether or not, or how we should allow, or what our attitude should be with regards to Arama, with regards to Ribbis. However, the Torah Tamima was the Baruch HaLevi Epstein, the son of the Aruch HaShulchan. He was a banker. He visited Yeshiva, I think. There's a picture of him in front of the old building, Torah Tamima, a funny bowler hat. Anyway, he was a banker. So, I don't know how successful a banker he was, but he was a banker. So he comments often about banking realities in his comments. So over here in the Torah Tamima, Parshas Bahar, the issue of collecting ribbis, so he writes that it wasn't necessary to have the Heter Iskei until the 17th century. What happened in the world in the 17th century? That was the Industrial Revolution. Until that time, we were an agrarian society. People earned money by farming. So, you know, when would you take a loan? You would take a loan as a provident loan, meaning I needed it to get me through this season because my crop didn't pan out. I need seeds to plant the next season, so I should have a parnasa. So it's kind of like a bridge loan to get me to where I needed to get. Then it's wrong to charge people ribbis because that's not how they made money. They didn't make money by investing capital. They made money by growing stuff and selling stuff. No, it was productive, right? They made stuff, they sold stuff, they did stuff. So it wasn't capital that created more capital. They used the capital to buy seeds and then grow crops. So then we understand, you know, it's viewed very negatively to to charge a person money to get, so they should be able to earn a parnasa. Let him earn a parnasa and don't, charge him interest so he could just get the loan to get to the next crop, to get to the next season. However, in the 1700s, as the cotton gin was invested in the Industrial Revolution, the whole economy shifted from an agrarian society to now a capitalistic society, where it's dafka through investing capital that people create more wealth. That's how the whole, economy was structured, and particularly for Jews who weren't allowed to own land in many of the countries which they lived, they needed to make money through investing money. They needed to be able to derive a profit and have minimal risk. So it was at that time that the Rabbanim saw we have to create this structure of the heter risk, otherwise no one's going to lend money to Jews. Just like Hillel saw in the Shemitah Ksafim, right, that people, loans were going to be canceled at the end of the Shemitah year, and therefore people are not going to lend money, so he created the Prisbo. In order to we need the free flow of credit to run an economy, right? People have to be able to lend money so people could start new ventures and start new businesses. So in order that people should lend money freely, the Rabbanim of the time developed this heteriska. And the reason why it wasn't viewed negatively is because it was a harama around ribis, but at the same time it was deemed necessary because of the times in order to keep the credit, flowing just along the same lines as Hillel, who created the Prisbo. So he just contextualizes where the heteriska, what time period it came up, and why it could perhaps receive a different attitude than the Goyin approached it with. However, Rabbi Isai, it is critical to remember, this is, when a loan is structured in this fashion, as an investment, it's critical to remember that we are structuring as an investment, and it's not interest, it's profits and dividends. And therefore, you should be careful, if you are lending money to other Jews, to not call it lending money, but to call it, if you're using a heteriska, to be careful to call it an investment, and to call it profits, and not to call it interest. You got to be careful about that. However, Rav Meish and Chassam Sofer both agreed that if, let's say, to protect their interest, they're nervous. Look, if I structure this as an iska, and I try and go after you in Beis Din, I'm going to have a hard time collecting. If you're a delinquent or you refuse to pay me, I'm going to have a hard time collecting. Because Beis Din has no arm to force people to pay. Beis Din just doesn't have that ability today. I'm going to have to go to secular court. Secular court is going to be confused by this heteriska. In fact, there's a whole case law already now regarding how heter iskas are interpreted by courts. It has a lot to do with how it's worded and how it's presented, and you could give a whole dissertation on how the secular courts have interpreted heter iskas. But it's a risk. It's a complication. And therefore, Rav Meish and Chassam Sofer both allowed for a primary mortgage document or loan document to be written as a loan, and a secondary heter iska to be drafted alongside, where it will be referred to as an investment with profits and dividends. They did allow the original loan document to be drafted with a loan, a borrower, and interest in order to protect your interest in secular court. If the person will prove to be delinquent and not pay, his things, you don't want to minimize your rights and privileges to go to secular court. But at that time, then the heteriska has to be worded properly, because you have to say the heteriska, is redefining the loan document, but at the same time not limiting your ability to pursue the loan if it will ever arrive in secular court. So it's got to be worded very carefully and very delicately. But it is important to remember how the heter iska is structured, how it really does work, and to be careful if you're using these kinds of structures to refer to it as an investment with profits and dividends and not as a loan with a borrower, a lender, and interest. All right, yeah.